This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
China cables, Russian bots, American titans, Euro dots, silicone brains, robot arms of the data farm.
Today we take you deep inside the hidden core of the new bubble, data centers. After 10 years exploring data farms in America, Singapore, and beyond, anthropologist Stephen Gonzalez Monserrate published his paper. It's called "The Cloud is Material on the Environmental Impacts of Computation and Data Storage." Then we tackle mountains of toxic wastes rushed from the Los Angeles fire zones.
Inside wires, chip display.
Like mushrooms after the rain, bland concrete buildings the size of football fields are popping up around the world. They guzzle electric power and water equal to small cities. There are a lot of reasons you need to know what is going on there. From the new American president to Microsoft to Amazon, everybody's announcing massive new data buildouts up to $500 billion at a time. In the corporate casino, these are sky-high bets. Some governments are hoping your tax dollars and bank accounts will be part of it. Remember, though, in just 1 week at the end of January, one new AI model from China knocked out $1 trillion in stock value. All this could crash much faster than 1929, now that machines make trades in less than a fraction of a second. AI promises everything, but so far has created very little, including any profits. Pension plans for 1 billion people, all our banks, our governments, we're totally invested in this stuff. Belief in the new idols of artificial intelligence and geopolitical computing power puts our whole economic system at risk. We won't have time to examine just how fragile this whole server farm gold rush really is. And this is not a financial program, but we can look at the environmental risks, for sure. We should also shudder at the new energy burden just at a time when we need to slash carbon emissions or face climate disasters that last for generations. Already, coal plants due to close have been kept open just to run artificial intelligence or crypto mining. Major corporations promise to build new gas-burning power plants right beside their mammoth server farms. Others plan to reopen antiquated nuclear plants for electricity. Microsoft's Bill Gates is dealing to reopen the shuttered Three Mile Island reactors in Pennsylvania, right beside America's first major meltdown. Those old General Electric Mark I reactors have known flaws, and they also blew up at 4 nuclear reactors at Fukushima, Japan. It is awe-inspiring, dangerous lunacy. So, there's that. This is a new wave of demand for electricity, and it will be larger than the addition of renewable energy. AI and crypto threaten to make all those solar panels and wind machines meaningless, lost in the thirst for new power. Unchecked by any authority, and boosted as the new economic miracle, this is a threat to the climate of the world. Let's go inside the data farms.
Radio EcoShock.
Beyond radio airwaves, these words travel through a vast network of computers, undersea cables, coolers, and fossil fuel burning, including coal. They call it the cloud. Where is the cloud? And what does it cost the atmosphere and the environment? Is it becoming a new life form? What happens as artificial intelligence and Bitcoin mining succeed? According to years of study by Dr. Stephen Gonzalez Monserrate, the cloud now has a greater carbon footprint than the airline industry. A single data center can consume the equivalent electricity of 50,000 homes. And we are just getting started with a boom in server construction globally. Dr. Gonzalez is an anthropologist of cloud storage. He is a digital sustainability advocate. Stephen has published in Wired and Popular Science. He's appeared on ABC News, the BBC, and more. From MIT, Stephen just took a new position as a postdoctoral researcher with the Fixing Futures Research Group. That is at Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany. From Frankfurt, Stephen Gonzalez Monserrate, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex.
Let's begin with the basics. What is the cloud?
It's a really good question, right? I think there are a few technical definitions of what it is, and I think there's also sort of a layman definition, and I tend to lean on the latter there. So for the average person who doesn't really have a grasp of the vast suite of technical systems that they're interfacing with on a day-to-day basis, you know, the cloud is pretty much everything that the internet touches. And so it includes your personal devices that you're using to access the internet, like your mobile phone. But it also includes these vast data transmission networks and undersea cables. You have these internet exchange centers that are packet switching all of the different data that make up the internet and make it happen. And then I think the part that for me is perhaps the most interesting is the places where data is processed and stored. And these are called data centers. You might have seen them. Also, server farms is another term that people use to refer to these. And essentially, they're vast warehouses that are filled with racks upon racks of computers. And these computers are performing calculations. They are storing information for us. They are maintaining and facilitating websites. They're essentially the engine behind everything. And without them, the cloud as we experience it would not be possible.
Google appears to have purpose-designed server buildings with a few human touches. Are all data centers futuristic like that?
Absolutely not. So, I mean, I think that there is maybe a tendency from movies now, and there's a lot of spy movies where you see a glimpse of this data center, and the data centers that these movies and films, and also the images that Google and so forth put out of their own data centers, they represent kind of the pinnacle of technological sophistication in these. But there are a number of data centers that are actually much more modest in design and scope, that lack the resources and technology to make them as energy efficient as have that beautiful aesthetic that you're starting to see. I mean, there's even a kind of cottage industry online of sort of data center photography, which is attempting to highlight the aesthetic beauty of these data centers and the kind of precision of how they're set up and so on, colorful or very pristine, austere, and white. But there are so many data centers that I have been to and set foot in that are actually sort of falling apart in some ways, you know, that there's a mess of cables everywhere. There's mold growing in parts of the data center that haven't been adequately cleaned. Some of these data centers are in basements of universities or libraries or other kinds of buildings. So not all of them are as sophisticated as you might think. And I think that's really important.
So you went to big data operations in several U.S. states, as well as Singapore, Iceland, and your native Puerto Rico. And as a professional ethnographer, you gained access into the holy of holies, really. How did you get that access?
Well, this is a great question, and I'm so glad that you asked it. Because, you know, data centers, as you might imagine, you know, just given what we've just discussed, right, the importance that they have in our society, for our civilization, if you want to put it that way. These facilities, many of them are highly secure facilities because all it takes is one person with a flash drive to introduce some kind of bug to the network that might hamper the operations of the facility, compromise the data of the many clients that data center is serving, and the cost of such a disruption is really, really high. And so they're very highly secure places, and getting access to them as a researcher was a bit tricky. And one of the ways that I was able to achieve that was through persistence, through many attempts to communicate with different people within the organization, but also demonstrating some kind of technical capacity or at least being open to learning. And in addition to that, the most important was really to the ability to respect the privacy of the companies. And so in my studies, I do not name specific facilities. I do not name specific participants. I use pseudonyms to anonymize these the people that I learned from who gave me so much of their time to really give me an insight into how these data centers are operated, how they're run, what the culture of this expert culture is really like. Also, doing the study at the time when data centers were, maybe I started this project back in 2015 when there was less public interest in these facilities. And I think now that there's more public interest, it's a lot harder to do the kind of study that I did because there's a lot more paranoia about what might be found and shared and so forth.
So in Aeon and in your other works, you've written about the people of the cloud. You call them caretakers, almost sounds like caregivers, rather than technicians. Talk about their work lives and the culture there.
A lot of people, when they ask me about data centers, they want to hear about the technology, which is great and interesting, and they should learn about it. But the people are really crucial to this enterprise, and I think that there is a bit of a myth that some people have internalized just because they think of this idea of progress and technology, and so they think that all these computers, these facilities basically run themselves, and there's no human input or human touch involved, or barely any. And to a degree, that is true in the sense that there isn't a huge workforce for a facility that might be, you know, this massive warehouse where you could easily get lost and not be able to find somebody for hours if you don't really know where you're going. And that might be staffed by maybe a dozen or a couple of dozen of people, and even in one shift there can be less than a dozen depending on the size of the data center and the particular shift. But that is all to say that humans are very much part of the story. And this industry tends to be very masculine in terms of who decides to work in a data center, who gets the skills. The skills come from a lot of different industries. Some data centers recruit ex-military. Because of the kind of sensitivity, the sort of like crisis mode, the ability to handle stress and pressure, these are things that data center companies are interested in their employees and in their personnel. So that creates a kind of atmosphere that's very masculine, and there's a transmission of expertise from one generation to another, and that's also really interesting to observe. You have the Gen Zs and the millennials like myself who are sometimes lower in the totem pole in terms of the level of their rank, in terms of their technician rank, and you have these older, more sometimes cantankerous senior folks who, you know, are passing on this knowledge, and it's really interesting to observe that. But, you know, it's also really high stress, and there is a kind of monotony to sometimes the job, right, because there's like a lot of walking around the data center, physically, you know, touching these computers and smelling for burnt cables, which is something I've seen and observed, listening for the sounds of fans before sensors tell them that something might be wrong with the cooling system or a specific server's onboard fan, or maybe the cooling is not evenly distributed. And some of these things require a human touch, a human presence, human senses. And it's really amazing to witness that, and also to find the ways that these technicians imbue their world with meaning, right? So some of the computers, some of the specific racks or computers sometimes get ascribed kind of like personality traits, right? And there's a certain, what I might call a mysticism that I've observed, you know, something like luck or magic, magical thinking that sometimes is in play, because the technical complexity is such that you might think you know what's going on, but there's so many moving parts, and sometimes things don't work the way that you might expect them to work, and you can't figure out why. And so this is where the luck and the kind of magical thinking comes in. So for me, it's been really amazing. It's been such a privilege to be able to observe that, and you know, and I'm somewhat critical of these folks, but I'm also really sensitive to the work that they're doing, and it's really an unsung labor that is making all of our digital lives possible. There are these men, mostly men, who are doing this work, and I find that fascinating.
You say the cloud is a carbivore. Talk to us about the climate concerns.
In many aspects, you know, cloud computing is metabolic. You know, that's what the way that I frame it in my work is that there's a degree of metabolism that is associated with computational processes. And that plays out in data centers where you have a significant amount of electricity that is used by the computers themselves to process information. to store information. And in the case of artificial intelligence, that processing is intensified. And so there's a much higher footprint of electricity involved to actually process and store that information. Now, we can also say that these data centers require a lot of energy to cool them as well. And so in the early days of data centers, much of this cooling was done solely with air, right? So air conditioning using the kind of refrigeration techniques that we're really familiar with in our own homes, but on a kind of much larger scale using this equipment called computer room air conditioners to actually cool the data centers. And that was really electricity intensive. But in the late 2010s and the mid 2010s, really, you started to see a transition where there was a lot more awareness. Many data centers started to use other techniques to cool, namely the water. Right, so water was a more efficient medium than air, and also cheaper in terms of the cost of water versus the cost of electricity. In many cases, was cheaper, and so many of these companies achieved significant electricity savings by turning to water. But what that resulted in is the data centers in 2022. It was the International Energy Agency said that data centers consume about 1% of the world's electricity. Right, so that's a pretty significant amount, even though it doesn't sound like it. And that number is set to grow significantly as artificial intelligence is further adopted and scaled up, and the infrastructure required to support it. Data centers are that infrastructure. And also, it's important to put into perspective that data centers are these facilities that, are consuming this vast amount of electricity, sometimes the equivalent of a small city in terms of the electricity, right? That's not insignificant. And additionally, you have the water footprint of some of these facilities, right, is also comparable to a small town per day. You have, 1 to 3 million gallons of water per day used in some facilities. And that's related to cooling and related to also sometimes to energy production and so on. But they are not innocent in that they do have a real environmental footprint. The desiccation of water supplies in the U.S. is also, identified by the IPCC, the United Nations, as one of the key drivers of climate change is desertification, is the process of transforming an environment into a desert. And when we deplete the water supplies of a specific community or area, that intensifies this process of climate change. So it's not just carbon emissions that is a concern for the climate.
So why don't they just put all the computer farms in Iceland or northern Scandinavia and get free cooling?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really good question that was imagined as a solution for a long time, especially in the late 2000s and early 2010s. There was this sort of almost like a fantasy that we could just put all the data there and harness the planet's its affordances. Like, the planet is providing, this cool climate that can be used as sort of like a natural refrigerator, and that was what the imagination was. And in some ways, it was very successful to put some data centers in Iceland and parts in other Nordic countries. But the problem, which is still a problem today, is the specific digital services that we use have different requirements of latency. And so latency is the delay, between phone call, when you're having an international phone call overseas, like we are ourselves, there could be a bit of latency. And that latency intensifies depending on the distance and the geography of the undersea cables that are supplying these signals are also part of this. And it's really complicated and it's not very intuitive. So it doesn't necessarily mean that if you're 1,000 kilometers away, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's this much slower. So it's not a one-to-one. It all depends on the routing of the different cables. But that being said, many of these services, we as customers and consumers have become so accustomed to speed and rapidity, and we come to value that. And that value is so intense that we are not willing to have, a 0.05 millisecond delay with latency for certain kinds of applications. Like, for instance, this was a big case when it came to gaming and online gaming, and there were people who were upset because the latency was giving other people an advantage. But that also plays out in the stock market, where you have people who are moving their base of operations, maybe just 500 meters or like maybe even 100 meters closer to the stock exchange to gain a nano fragment of a of a latency advantage on a competitor. So yeah, latency is a huge issue, and this is why we can't just put all of the data centers there. But also, you know, even if there is no carbon footprint, there also has to be a sufficient capacity to generate the electricity needed. And I think this is something that is also not discussed, right? Is you know, you can have renewable energy from a renewable grid, but you also have to have sufficient electricity to supply the data centers. And so what we're seeing in Ireland, for instance, is that there's just so much demand for electricity that the grid cannot support or is struggling to support that demand, where, you know, in Ireland, about 20% of the electricity consumed is going to data centers. So, yeah, so that's just one example.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Dr. Stephen Gonzalez Monserrate. Do they have big data centers in China, and are they running on renewables?
China does have data centers, and for a long time, actually, until about, I think, 2019 or so, there was a bit of a cryptocurrency production boom in China, and that was because of this kind of lack of regulations and the cheapness of electricity, and many of those crypto mines were really dirty in terms of the energy or mix. But the government decided to crack down on those, and they have since mostly relocated to Kazakhstan, and now there's some in Iceland, and now they're moving to other parts of the world as well. But, you know, the Chinese do have, they have a significant amount of data centers, and sometimes data centers are also necessary, not only because you need storage, but because of the geopolitics of the internet, right? So, and what I mean by that is, you know, if you live in China, you have limited access to certain kinds of websites. And the same goes for being in the U.S. or being in the EU, that there are certain, there's even a geography of information that you can reach and websites and content. And that a lot has to do with the sovereignty of data, you know, where data is data secure enough, right? So there are security concerns that make it, you know, certain parts of the internet not accessible to people living in China that are security concerns of the Chinese government. And so there has to be the construction of more data centers within the nation state itself or in closer proximity to it where they have control over those kinds of operations. So that's part of the reason why there's also a lot of data centers there. But also because it's a marketplace, and there's a huge amount of competition, right? With and Huawei is one example of a company that has a lot of data centers, right, which is competing globally. So they exist, you know, all over the world. So I would say, they do have data centers. And in terms of their sustainability, I mean, I think for a long time it was sort of something like the Wild West, but that has changed because you know, like in Beijing, for instance, data centers that have a power utilization effectiveness of, you know, 1.2 are no longer permitted, right? So I think these kinds of, there is a sense that the environment does matter, but also the electricity capacity matters, right? Like they do not want to create a scenario where their power grid cannot support the growth. And I think that's especially important now with the advent of artificial intelligence and the kind of intensification of artificial intelligence-ready equipment in data centers.
For a while, big American tech companies promised to run on renewables or somehow make up for their carbon belching with carbon credits or something. Now, with the new administration in particular, all that seems to be out the window. There's a big race towards AI everything. What do you make of the billion-dollar schemes to build gas generators or even open up old nuclear plants as part of gargantuan data centers?
No, I mean, I find it very concerning for many reasons. I mean, I think that, yes, like, technically speaking, like, nuclear energy is renewable, but we have seen the consequences time and time again of failures, right? The consequences that cannot be reversed to the environment, the radiation that leaches into soils, water supplies, and everything, right? That this is not easy to shake if something does go wrong with these sites, right? And then there's also the issue of nuclear waste, of radioactive waste, and so on. And I think another important part to mention here is that nuclear power plants consume a similar amount of water as data centers to keep themselves sufficiently cool, in many cases, depending on their construction. But that tends to be the standard or norm. So I would also say that they're not necessarily more sustainable in terms of the water issue. That is, I think, probably the biggest issue with data centers now and AI going forward. also a concern from my perspective of there is this sense of hype or this sense of anticipation that artificial intelligence is absolutely essential and necessary, inevitable. There's so many, I mean, billions of dollars invested in this industry. But in terms of the actual returns on this investment, we are not really seeing those on any kind of scale that is justifying these vast capital investments. And so my big concern is that the data centers, there's all this investment in constructing data centers, but we have seen in the history of data centers, many data centers that are constructed and then get dismantled. Right. So there is also this hype around the data center providing a lot of jobs, which has just been proven time and time again not to be the case. And all of this investment in capital that might actually be temporary. And so that's the other concern that I have is that there, if more nuclear power plants are built or old one, defunct ones are reactivated, and then the AI boom becomes something like a dot-com bust or an AI bust, you know, that we saw in the early 2000s. That would be, you know, really devastating economically to a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, shortly after the Americans announced a $500 billion server farm project, then a Chinese company developed AI using older chips and less energy. There's also the fragility that comes from this whole quantum chip thing. It might reduce energy and cooling, although those chips need to be near absolute zero, even colder, minus 273 C or minus 459 Fahrenheit. That's amazing. So as you try to plot out this future that maybe threatens our future, do you expect there could be new developments that might shrink the risk, maybe shrink it a lot and make this work?
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly open to that possibility. I mean, I think as a researcher, I have to be both skeptical and critical, but also the point of doing the scholarship that I'm doing and communicating it to the public is, and also to these companies in some cases, is so that they can do things differently and try to make improvements, because we can't get rid of these data centers. We've become so dependent on them that it's unimaginable, cataclysmic even, to propose de-digitalization entirely, I think, at this point, without a vast restructuring of society. There is certainly a possibility that there will be some innovations that can change the game. I also think that there are different technologies that are on the horizon. I'm currently researching what I'll call very low climate footprint forms of information storage that actually have a longer, that are related to technologies that we're very familiar with, like tape and, you know, more analog technologies like books. Storage is only part of the problem. It only solves part of the problem. But there are, for example, a lot of investments and research being done on the possibility of using molecular storage, so a kind of synthetic DNA that is based on the proteins, the very proteins that, you know, life is coded from. I mean, there are also these kinds of ceramics and optical, like 5D laser etched glass type technologies that have about 10,000 times the capacity of storage than, like, you know, a comparable digital technology today. And, you know, I think the advantage of these technologies that I'm proposing, which is something we haven't talked about yet, is that they are very durable and they can last for thousands of years potentially, if depending on, you know, how they're constructed and implemented. Whereas our digital systems, and we haven't really talked about this, is they are actually incredibly fragile from the perspective of this longer history. Our solid-state drives start to fail and have, like, errors and bit rot, you know, within 10 years of use, and the HDD drives even worse. And, you know, we have these ancient technologies like cuneiform tablets that are 6,000 years old that you can still read the information encoded on them. I mean, it's not as convenient or as dense, but, you know, it's just an example to say that, you know, there needs to be some innovation and rethinking radically what information is and how it can be stored. But yeah, it is possible in the future that the data center industry or these many different tech sectors will find a way to mitigate or cancel out the electricity consumption. But, you know, the International Energy Agency is expecting 2.5 to 3 to even 7%. The range is pretty intense, right, of increase in electricity use by 2030. And I would say that that is concerning, because that will require a lot of also electricity infrastructure, as you pointed out. And how they will go about doing that is really a question that has not been satisfactorily answered yet.
We will be right back with more from Dr. Stephen Gonzalez Monserrate.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Please, please support your local radio station with a good donation.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Anthropologist Stephen Gonzalez Monserrate published the paper, "The Cloud is Material, on the Environmental Impacts of Computation and Data Storage." So now you're part of a team at Goethe University trying to map out new ways of understanding the future, hopefully before it kills us. What does the Fixing Futures Research Group do?
Yeah, so we're really a collection of scholars from different fields. There are some doctoral students. There's also the principal investigators and postdocs like myself. We come from geography, sociology, anthropology, and science and technology studies, which is sort of a field that is really interested in understanding technology and science and their social impacts, but also their histories and the politics of certain kinds of technology. So it's important for us to ask these questions, and that's what we do as a research group, and we're really engage in a range of different topics, everything from using algae as a carbon sink technology to PFAS, so the forever chemicals and their future, the future of finance and so on. There's so many different questions that we're asking together and individually, and generally what we want to do is to provide a nuanced picture of what is possible for the future, and to inform our fields, but also the wider public on what those possibilities are.
Well, I have a couple of huge questions with only a couple of minutes left, but we'll give it a shot. I know that you have said we also need speculative fiction to explore these complex problems. I mean, just to imagine it. And as a fiction author under the pen name E.G. Conde, you invented something called Tainofuturism. Does that allow hope in spite of everything?
So, I mean, I think speculative fiction, like as a social scientist, I think speculative fiction is really important to take seriously, because yes, it's entertaining, but it can also be very instructive, and it can also be really rich with a commentary. And also, from my perspective, it can provide a blueprint for what is possible. And we've already seen, science fiction and speculative fiction do this. We see the likes of Elon Musk and other people like Mark Zuckerberg citing science fiction. I mean, the metaverse, right? It comes from Snow Crash, Neal Stephenson. many of these ideas and concepts, like Neuralink, they come from science fiction, and the people who are inventing them now or rolling them out are actually very, very consciously connecting this and even broadcasting that connection because of the capital or the interest that creates around and excitement around the technology rollout. For me, speculative fiction provides us a blueprint. It provides us with scenarios. It provides us with possibilities for thinking otherwise. It's not necessarily about predicting the future, but it's about modeling what can be, because if we only have these like very limited visions of what is possible, then we will just end up repeating history again and again, right? And so for me, I'm glad you brought up Tainofuturism, which is a kind of indigenous futurism from the Caribbean, and which is where my ancestors come from. The idea is to think about how we can both achieve a kind of future of prosperity in a part of the world that has a long history of struggle, both in terms of the politics of the U.S. and in its relationship to Puerto Rico, but also being in the path of hurricanes that are being exacerbated by climate change. And so how do we deal with that? And for me, in my storytelling, the answer is to looking to the past and looking to the ancestors and looking to them for inspiration for new kinds of technologies and new forms of social and political organization that chart a new course, something radically different. Is it very likely or possible? Maybe, maybe not. But I think it's still important to have a blueprint, to have a path, that you can actually visualize and see.
In the United States, climate science is being eliminated. Even the language of climate science is being wiped away wherever they can scrub it. The new administration is trying to suppress gender expression, and the tech giants who run those farms you monitored have literally taken over the government, and they're appearing as neocolonialists and worse. You just changed from America to Europe. Do you feel like a refugee, Stephen?
I mean, in some ways, yes, but, you know, but here in Germany, in Deutschland, you know, we do have kind of like in many parts, it's this sort of troubling rise of the far right, and we do have an election actually next week, so you've caught me at a good time. But, you know, I do think, yeah, in some ways I am grateful to be in Europe. It has been given me a lot of perspective, really, on the U.S. and, you know, the issues there. But I am very concerned about the changes that are this new administration is affecting in the U.S. government. And the guardrails, the few guardrails that we had for these tech companies and really for corporations in general, are being swept away at a level that is hard to imagine. I mean, when we're talking about data centers in the cloud and tech companies, they have largely regulated themselves, even under previous administrations. There hasn't been any substantial or significant regulation. The EU, there is, to some degrees, some limitations and differences, especially with respect to the AI Act and privacy concerns. But I think the future in the U.S. now, especially, as you said, climate science is being politicized to the point where it will likely not even be funded. I mean, that is a huge concern because our ability to map and predict and understand the dynamics of something as complex as the climate is really crucial for our survival, really, and also to be able to anticipate and intervene in what will be really significant changes to our way of life as more hurricanes come, as droughts cycle in, and, you know, extreme weather events of various kinds sweep over the continental U.S. and elsewhere. I think we do have to be prepared for that. And without climate science, I don't see a way that we can address that.
From the Fixing Futures Research Group at Goethe University in Frankfurt, we've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Gonzalez Monserrate. You can find links to his paper, The Cloud is Material, on the environmental impacts of computation and data storage, and more of his public articles from Stephen, all in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Get the links there. Stephen, thank you for spending time with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex.
For Radio EcoShock, I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Before we go to the case of burned-out Los Angeles and soil scorching, I want to pass on just a couple of bits of climate news. No one else is going to tell you. News and social media has been consumed by the drama of American politics. Meanwhile, nature continues to change radically as more greenhouse gases pour into the atmosphere every day. So-called zombie fires have taken a new twist. Enormous wildfires in the far north continued burning under the snow in recent years, flaring up again in the spring. Now Canadian fire expert Mike Flanagan, a guest on this program, reports, quote, in 2024, a significant portion of the British Columbia area burned was due to 2023 fires that survived the winter. This is the first time I have seen fires survive two winters in Canada. Friends, are we entering a time of never-ending fires? On to our second guest. California Governor Gavin Newsom reported February 17th that 7,100 residential parcels in Los Angeles were cleared of the household hazardous waste after the fires. Really? The incoming Trump administration slashed environmental protection standards for this to make it happen. Only the top 6 inches of toxic ash are being removed. No measurements are being taken. And toxic waste is being spread over famous beaches for sorting. In fact, we don't know much about soil burned out in cities, or even how to restore millions of acres burned by wildfires each year in America alone. We need to look deeper. Winter fires in New Jersey, Canadian towns burned down, and then part of Los Angeles is wiped out by fire. It's the same in many parts of the world. Remember the Greek fires just last year? It has come to this. All of us need to understand how to care for land after the wildfire. Your beloved home site may be toxic. The soil can be burned dead. The wind will spread particles of ash huge distances for weeks or months afterwards, making this everybody's problem. What can be done? Russell Taylor is a soil expert. Headquartered in Utah, he does soil restoration for a living. Russell knows how dirt works before and after fires. From the 2025 World Ag Expo in Tulare, California, Russell Taylor, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me, Alex.
I'm glad you are here. So let's get to work. After cities burned down in recent years, authorities cordoned off the area and delayed the return of residents. You couldn't even get back there. Would toxic fire ash be a factor as a public health threat?
Yeah, so what happens when you burn certain products such as plastics and some of these man-made compounds? It creates some potentially negative things for both the soil and the humans. And also some of the contents of those things. You know, heavy metals are one concern, like lead, arsenic, cadmium, mercury. The other one would be polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or what they call PAHs. And those are resulting from burned organic matter. Other carcinogens such as dioxins, furans, and plastics can also create some additional chemicals. So something to pay attention to. There's some other potentially negative outcomes, and those would be things like the result of burnt products. So like wood products, for example. When you burn wood products, it actually creates wood ash, which is extremely alkaline. And so that can negatively impact just simple soil parameters such as soil pH, making soil correction also necessary.
About 12,000 homes and businesses burned to the ground in Los Angeles fires of January. Picture a family returning to their lot. They just arrived, maybe with a shovel and a rake. What would you say to homeowners planning to rebuild or recover?
So the first thing to pay attention to is some of that dust is respiratory, and the risk is respiratory. So a lot of times just sweeping up that ash can stir up those contaminants. And so I know people want to be ambitious and go and sweep those things up, but you're going to get heavy metals and those things like in the dust. So, you know, wear an N95 mask, try not to stir up any dust, try to wet the dust before you do sweep it up to try to minimize the exposure. And the next thing is, you know, sometimes washing that dust down the street is just moving the problem down the road. So, you know, follow guidelines and try to clean up as best you can and pay attention to both your risk and the risk downstream.
Seen from the air, Russell, just the blocks and blocks of homes burned in Malibu. They look like a massive gray graveyard. A lot of homeowners will not be able to rebuild for various reasons, and they may not rehabilitate their ground either, and then you get little ash pockets still threatening other homeowners with every wind. Can such a big restoration really happen with every homeowner on their own, or do you foresee a larger government project to make the whole area safe again?
So being a private company, I really can't speak to the government interest and involvement. You know, I would encourage homeowners to, you know, take ownership of both their land and their neighborhoods. And there's things that can be done at the small level, you know, planting plants, creating barriers that would capture any moisture that would run off another property. Those type of things, cover crops, all can be done to help reduce, you know, your exposure from those neighbors.
And after fire, we may picture the ground left with soft ashes, but maybe the afterground could instead turn into a hard layer that's unfriendly to plants. So what do you think will happen there?
Right. So there's a couple of negative impacts that happen when you burn soil. And the number one thing is soil organic matter. So your soil organic matter has three major components that should be a concern. You know, and the first is the microbiology that's living there. Depending on the heat of the fire, you could actually kill those soil microbes. The next thing is burning off your two organic pools. You have your active organic matter, which is food for microbes. It helps cover the soil, keep the soil cool, moist, and hold in moisture. Your passive fraction of your soil organic matter is actually gone through degradation already, and it contributes to soil structure. And people don't realize this, but you know, think of it as like caramel in a nut roll. It helps form those soil aggregates. And those soil aggregates are responsible for percolation of water, infiltration of water, and storage of water. So a lot of times when you have these high heat fires, you kill the soil biology and the soil structure, and those soils become hydrophobic in nature, where the water hits the surface and repels instead of penetrates. So there's certain amendments you can use to help mitigate and re-improve your soil organic matter.
Another important cycle in California, well, everywhere really, is drought and flooding. And these two interact, so flooding may be more likely after drought hardens the land. Does the legacy of wildfires play into this drought and flood back and forth?
The organic matter is really your reservoir for your water. Now, I can't speak to the weather patterns because that's not my expertise. But what I can say is the number one thing any homeowner can do is improve their soil organic matter for two reasons. It impacts your percolation rate, so that means it actually can help that water run through the soil profile, and it also creates what they call micropores. And micropores hold moisture through what they call capillary action. And most people might be familiar with this when they put a straw in a glass of water and they see the water kind of pull up in that straw. That's capillary action. And so when you have that happen in the soil, what happens is you actually increase your water holding capacity. And I'll give a number that's used by the USDA National Resource Conservation Service, and the acronym NRCS. And they say that a 1% change in soil organic matter will conserve 30,000 more gallons of water per acre. Well, that's a meaningful number for any homeowner. I mean, 30,000 gallons will fill a lot of swimming pools. But that makes use of water from rain events and from water coming down through the surface to help that percolate in the soil instead of just run off. So in the greater scheme of things, you know, focusing on soil organic matter is something you can do and you can impact, whereas, you know, those weather-related events, you know, a little bit harder to predict and plan for.
So after every fire, the next heavy rains can bring hillsides down into homes and shops. But you say the problem and the solution is not just about replanting, getting some plants above the soil, but repairing the actual dirt itself. Why is that a factor and why do we have to do that first?
Right. So, again, those soil colloid has collapsed. So those things that were holding that soil structure open are now closed, and so the water can't penetrate. And so there's two mechanisms to do that. You can change the surface tension of the water through a surfactant. That helps the water penetrate the soil. But adding organic matter, it helps form those soil structures. So adding compost, manures, products like humates and humic acids, those things help create soil structure that would allow that rain after that fire event to help penetrate the soil and begin the healing process. Because there's a few things that need to occur, and that's water for seeds for germination, and also creating a soil structure that prevents runoff, because it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that water can't get into soil, it runs off the surface. It takes soil with it, and so you're now degrading further soil structure and soil organic matter that's run off into the streams and the lakes.
So you're in a private business. It's called Live Earth Products. It's in Utah. Without naming specific products, what do we need on a large scale to restore viable soils in this age of increasingly intense wildfires?
So to understand products like humates and humic acids that Live Earth Products manufactures, you need to understand soil organic matter. Now, soil organic matter, again, has two components, an active pool and a passive pool. Now, the active pool is being actively broken down by the soil microbes. So to give you an example, let's say you put 100 pounds of compost down. In 1 year, your soil microbes will degrade that 100 pounds by 60 to 80 pounds. 60 to 80% of your active organic matter goes back to the air as CO2 the first year. So those things that you're applying to build up soil organic matter, they're being degraded quickly. You need to add more of them. So to change your soil organic matter 1% using active organic matter, it would take about 200,000 pounds of organic matter per acre. Change your soil organic matter 1%. That's a lot of material. So products like humate and humic acid, the Live Earth Products manufacturers, have already gone through that degradation process. We're basically mining an ancient tropical forest floor. So that material is fully degraded and is able to be broadcast just like a fertilizer. And people can use that to amend their fertilizers or their soils to help retain fertilizers and make those nutrients and water last longer. So focusing on your soil organic matter will do two things. It'll help build structure. It'll help retain nutrients. And then last, but most importantly, it also creates a home for both microbes and life that may have been destroyed in that fire.
I know a lot of home gardeners are listening closely to what you just said. Do you know if government planners at various levels, do you happen to know this, are they including proper soil cleaning and restoration in their plans?
That I don't know. Most of my background is actually in agronomy and in agricultural efforts. So you actually see programs through the NRCS that would supplement soil organic matter and nutrient plans to farmers in larger scale, and I'm assuming some smaller farmers may also be able to use these programs to help get government support for using these conservation practices to improve soil organic matter and nutrient retention.
Well, on the farm front, we interviewed farmers organizing to measure carbon capture in their soils, possibly as another income for the farm. But it sounds impossible to repair wildland soils the way we might in a Los Angeles suburb. Maybe we're seeing a widespread change in soils across the West and parts of South America, wherever fires are burning, due to the intensity of wildfires. Do you have any opinions on that?
My opinions are not regional. They're more focused on soil organic matter itself. So I can't speak to one region in South America or other places in the United States as much as I can. Soil organic matter is universal. It's a universal storage system for water and nutrients. And anytime there's a fire, that should be the number one focus, is improving your soil organic matter.
Dr. Mike Flanagan, he's a Canadian fire expert, and he told us on radio two factors can prevent a forest from growing back. First, if another fire burns that area within 5 years, that kills the baby trees before they develop seeds. But the second, some recent fires have burned so hot, he says, that the soil was sterilized. Not much grows there for a long time. Russell, have you heard of that, and is there a way to restore badly burned soil?
Yeah, so those you've got two types of fires. One would be a simple brush fire like you would see in the Midwest, where the grass is flashed and burned off quickly, and even the grass plant itself is not damaged. These super fires that are burning really hot, where you actually change the soil organic matter, you're burning away both the soil microbes, the active organic matter, and the passive organic matter, those are all destroyed. For me, I'm a more of a field of dreams kind of guy. If you build it, they will come. If you create an environment that's favorable for soil microbes, those soil microbes will live and proliferate. And they're usually brought in through rainwater and rivers, streams. All those things will supply certain microbes. Now, you can amend those soils and soil microbes, and those consortia-type products will have a broad spectrum of microbes that are favorable for soil growth. So the problem I have with that is, these microbes may not be regionally favorable for you. So the microbes that are doing well in soils in Florida might not do well in soils in Maine or some colder climate. So that's something to pay attention to when you're amending soil microbes. I'm a big proponent of amending the soil with those components the microbes need, such as improving soil organic matter, both passive and active pools. Those things that contribute to microbe food, and also those things that are home for microbe by improving soil structure.
Can plants be used to remove contaminants from fire-damaged soil?
Absolutely. And there's some fun things about phytoremediation where you can actually plant plants that would specifically absorb toxins and heavy metals. Something such as sunflower, mustard greens, even ferns would remove arsenic from the soil. The one thing is to pay attention to those plants you're planting, remove them and dispose of them correctly because you are aggregating things such as arsenic and heavy metals in those plants.
You have some advice for Los Angelinos who are facing fire loss. What do you advise for the short-term and then longer-term goals for soil restoration after a fire?
So I think the first thing is make sure you're not losing your topsoil. That's the number one thing, to prevent runoff and erosion. To establish some barriers such as straw mats and those things on the slope side of the property where that soil might go. It takes thousands of years to make that top inch of soil organic matter. And so you want to retain that. Even if that soil organic matter wasn't burned off, if you burned off that material that was anchoring it, such as the lawn, the leaf, the litter, those type of things, any type of barrier to prevent runoff or erosion is key. Minimize the disturbance and try to take those ash-covered areas and make sure you're wearing an N95 mask and sweeping that ash up and removing those possible contaminants for exposure, both humans and those downstream. Other things that you might consider is even assessing the damage as far as what you have as far as heavy metals, whether that be soil testing or testing for other compounds such as polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, dioxins, furans, those are a little more expensive tests, so you know, you might pay some caution to that and assess whether there's a risk or not. But monitoring your soil quality, just such as pH, you know, sometimes soil pH makes a big difference in reestablishing plants. You know, get something growing. And that's one mantra you'll see in regenerative agriculture is always have living roots. We want to make that soil live. You want to feed the soil microbes. And plants actually have what they call root exudate. They're actually exuding a little bit of that carbon out in the soil. And so by keeping live plants in that soil, you're improving that soil. Even if the plan is to grow lawn later or a garden or something, get something there growing now, an annual crop, even oats, you know, something like that to keep live roots in the soil.
You just stepped out from a major conference to speak with us. What goes on at World Ag Expo?
World Ag Expo is a cornucopia of the world. You see farmers from all over the world here, both excited to showcase their wares, learn about equipment, and learn about soil amendments. So as a manufacturer of soil amendments, Live Earth's been here for about 15 years now, and we're happy to contribute to this large commerce, and it's just a lot of fun. Farmers and agricultural providers from around the world.
Speaking from Tulare, California, our guest is global soil earth expert Russell Taylor. He is vice president of Live Earth Products in Utah. You can find links to follow up in my show blog, Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Russell, thank you for reminding us about the facts below our feet.
Thank you for having me, Alex. Appreciate it.
For Radio EcoShock, I'm Alex Smith. The Los Angeles Times reports, quote, Army Corps officials are saying that excavating 6 inches of topsoil is enough to rid fire-devastated properties of hazardous pollution. The decision surprised L.A. County officials. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers said Wednesday that it won't order soil testing at properties damaged by the Eaton and Palisade fires after they have been cleaned by private federal contractors. That breaks with a long-standing safeguard to ensure no lingering contamination is left behind after wildfires, end quote. As California author and journalist Susie Cagle at Blue Sky writes, so many people are going to suffer for a generation, if not more, because of the breakneck pace of every level of government seems intent on pushing in this recovery, end quote. We have so much to learn about what happens to soil and soil life when cities burn, when great forests burn, in this newly overheated world. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening, hanging in there, and still caring about this world.